The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Are you ready, Heritage Radio? For the straw that stirs the drink, he walks with the animals. He talks with the animals. He likes to eat his piggies pink. He is an M-E-A-T-M-A-N meat man.
Meat man!
He's the author of the forthcoming book, The Carnivore's Manifesto. Here he is, Patrick Martin.
Wow. That's new.
I just got intimidated.
I can tell Sleepy Joe ain't back there today. We got Jack in studio.
Oh, man. This is like the first main course I've done this year, I think.
Yes, it's an honor to have you. And on the first one, does this count as post-Labor Day, Sunday? No, it's not.
Labor
Day's on Monday, so yeah. No.
Nope.
But it's part of the beginning of the week that is those days. So I would like to say this is the first show of the season on HRN. Is that acceptable?
We'll call it episode zero.
I'm here with the president
zero.
And vice president.
I mean, the season starts the week after. But
so I don't mind being zero.
It's
double
a pre-show.
Zero.
Yeah.
Who's double zero, Jack? Famous NBA double zeros. Benoit Benjamin.
Gilbert Arenas was a zero.
Gilbert Arenas.
Remember him?
Was
he had the guns in the locker room.
Yes. Yeah.
I didn't know that was allowed to have a zero, much less a double zero.
Double zeros, which means bathroom. My mom would be like, why would you name your number after a bath? I mean, why would your number be a bathroom sign in Europe? I was like, Mom. It's also the first number of the numerical system. It doesn't have to be.
It's also doppio zero is the flour you would use to make.
Oh, yeah. Super fun.
All right. Super fine flour to make pizza. And also, it's also the refined keef to make hashish. They call it double zero.
Very nice.
James Bond started with a double zero.
It's true.
I think we have a title for this week's episode.
Double zero. Which also, ironically, is sadly the number of listeners I have. But we are very honored. You've heard some voices so far. Is Joe Carroll. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me in.
And he also does a female voice, which you've been hearing. You've been doing a great job. It sounds like there's two people in the studio. We also have Aaron Fairbanks, the executive director of the Heritage Radio Network, who just very whimsically happened to be here and agreed to sit in for the first part of the interview.
I'm honored to sit in.
So it's really an honor to have Joe in studio because he's kind of like a legend. Aaron and I were talking earlier about how they're this, like, throughout the country, there's, you know, obviously very famous people, like, you know, Bourdain would be famous or Batali. But then there's also these people, you know, those are like global stars and this and that. But then there's this, like, series of stars around the country, you know, that are doing these amazing things that are, you know, kindred spirits with all these other people in all these other cities that are also doing miracles. And Joe really has a bunch of very like anchor places in the minds of New Yorkers, you know, either people who moved here or people like myself who were born and raised here. So I'll just say this list and we'll talk about them and then we'll get into some questions. I think Aaron has some questions, but Spuitendyvel, which is, that's historic. When did that open?
That is 10 years. Nice. In about 2 weeks, it will be our 10-year anniversary. So in September, I believe 13th, 2003.
Well, let's just kind of get into it just so that we can get past what you have done. Now, that did some very unusual things with beers especially, right? You kind of opened up some streams that didn't exist there. Explain to our listeners.
I mean, I think clearly there were craft beer bars before we existed in 2003. What we did, I think, that nobody else was really doing at the time in the country, and now a lot of people are doing, which I think is wonderful, is a few things. One was we created an environment, a bar that wasn't a dive bar or a sports bar or kind of like a frat bar kind of vibe, which most beer bars up until that time were. Mm-hmm. The vibe at Spuitendyvel is much more cafe-like. It's we keep the lights a bit brighter at night. There are a lot of women who go there. We have a pretty serious wine program all by the glass, but there's a lot of people who come to Spuitendyvel, neighborhood people, who think we're a wine bar, and mm-hmm. they come and they drink wine. That's all they drink. Mm-hmm. Although we are really, really a beer bar. There's no question about it. But the point was that we had to do everything good. We couldn't just have some good beer. Mm-hmm. But then the other thing that we did, the other approach we had was to only focus on very small production, very serious, well-made craft beers. And at the time, it was almost all coming from overseas because, well, two reasons. One, there weren't anywhere near the amount of domestic craft breweries a decade ago that are now available. But even even what was out there 10 years ago, very little of that was available in New York City. Mm-hmm. So we were dealing with a lot of product from overseas that, you know, a lot of these breweries were in people's garages. I mean, they were glorified home breweries, really.
Previously not imported at all, or were they imported to certain places?
A lot of the stuff was imported. There, at the time, there were really two serious importers of craft beer. Now there are three. Mm-hmm. I mean, which is saying something because, you know, there's so much beer here now, and there's still really only three serious importers of craft beer.
Representing which countries? Like basically Western Europe?
Exactly. You know, predominantly Belgium, of course, but also the UK and Germany. And now that has really branched out to Asia and to Scandinavia.
Well, let's talk about Western Europe. I've always heard Garrett Oliver, ever since I knew him, he always dropped this number of like 2,500, 3,000 microbreweries. I mean, maybe it's 3,500 around here in America, more or less.
Right.
What would that number be for Western Europe? Or would it be 3,500 for Belgium alone?
Belgium certainly has the most breweries and the most beer styles of anywhere else in Europe. Although, you know, I hesitate to say that because forever it would have been Germany. I'm just not sure anymore because so many of the small local breweries in Germany have closed. Mm-hmm. It's not like it was 30, 40, 50 years ago in Germany and years prior where every town of any decent size had their own brewery. Mm-hmm. There's still, mentally in Germany, there's still this feeling about, you know, only drinking local beer. And the Germans are a little odd about how they feel about other beers that aren't from their hometown. Mm-hmm. They kind of think it's poison if it mm-hmm. wasn't brewed in their hometown. Yeah. And they're very skeptical. I mean, we have Germans come in and see some of the beers that we have from Germany, like Mars, for example, Mars Brewery in Bamberg. And they don't believe that it's really Mars beer because in Germany, unless you're in Bamberg, it's mm-hmm. Almost impossible to find it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because wherever you are, they're just selling the local beers and that's that.
Yeah, yeah.
So to come to New York City, to come to Brooklyn and see Mars beer, it seems insane.
Yeah, yeah,
how
really.
Would that be?
How is
you know?
That possible?
How could you have it in Brooklyn? We can't get it, you know, 50 miles away from Bamberg.
Right.
So I do want to hear about, I know that it's so regional out there. I mean, this isn't really connected, but I always laughed. I asked this Italian guy once. I was like, so they're always talking about dividing Italy in half, you know, and separating the South from the North because they're like other, like, where is that imaginary line? And he's like, the first town to the south of you. That's
right.
Where the
right.
line,
of course.
You know, it's just
right.
Everything is different. So we're going to jump now to another institution. This is a very interesting barbecue place. People come far and wide. It's arguably the most interesting and tastiest barbecue, you know, being produced in the five boroughs, which is saying something because, you know, it's people are like, oh, barbecue isn't great, you know, here. But this is acknowledged as a national source of barbecue. It kind of did away with this traditional waiting tables. You basically stand in a line and in the same amount of time it would take you, even if it's a long line, to get food at a table. You would basically bring it to these communal tables and they have a huge whiskey bar. It is very, very delicious food. All menu items are listed by breed. That is very, very, very unusual and might be unique completely for considering the volume they have to be able to mention every single product by breed. So a great thing for heritage breed movement and for biodiversity. So tell us about Fete Sal.
Fete Sal.
Oh.
You got it. You got it. I got into barbecue. Look, I grew up in North Jersey. My family's from the Bronx. I have no barbecue lineage, you know. And I got into barbecue when I was in college. I went to NYU, so I was in New York too. Not like New York back in the very early 90s was a barbecue mecca by any means. But a friend of mine was working for a management company that handled Mojo Nixon. I don't know if you remember Mojo Nixon. Rockabilly kind of guy. And whenever he was in town, he wanted to go to Brothers Barbecue, which was on Houston Street at the time. Not to be confused with Brother Jimmy's. And Brothers Barbecue was like a real deal Carolina, North Carolina style barbecue place. And it was good, man. It was really good. And the only thing I had in my taste memory that I could equate to barbecue was, as a kid growing up, my dad had a very good friend who was this Puerto Rican guy. He was actually dean at Rutgers University, but in the summer, he would throw these insane pig roasts. Mm. And it's that same slow-cooked, unctuous pork that immediately connected with barbecue because of eating this growing up. And I just loved it. Absolutely fell in love with it. So this was probably 1990-ish when I first really had barbecue in New York. I'm not sure I had barbecue anywhere else prior to that. I mean, I'd been down south and stuff, but I knew what it was. It just wasn't really on my radar, though, the same way.
Wow, you're really building this restaurant up pretty big. I knew nothing. Right. I had nothing. No, because traditionally, barbecue is one of those things more than any other cuisine in America that one associates with some type of history.
Right. And that's, expertise.
I learned it from
absolutely.
So-and-so.
Right. So I taught myself how to barbecue. My parents still to this day live out in Jersey, but I was living in Manhattan at the time.
Did you buy a piece of equipment?
I bought a bullet smoker, like a $40 bullet smoker. Uh-huh. I kept it out at my parents, and every few weekends I would go out there and spend the night. And
what were you learning about the meat during these trials, like, or about the effect of fire or heat, things, smoke?
Well, everything. I mean, from how a rack of ribs cooks compared to how a brisket cooks, but also what wood to use, how much wood to use, temperatures, cook time, all that stuff. Read as much as I possibly could, and that's something that you can't say enough about. If you don't know something, read as much as you can about it. Talk to as many people who do know about it, and absorb all that knowledge, and then start experimenting with that knowledge base. And that's really what I did. And I think I took to it pretty well. I had grown up cooking my whole life, so I knew food very well. I had been a home brewer prior to that. So I knew how to do things like that. I wasn't completely clueless, mm-hmm. but, it took some trial and error, of course, but I did take to it fairly well. And, the funny thing, basically the first dry rub I ever came up with is the dry rub we use at Fat Disciple to this day. Yeah. And I really enjoyed it. I loved it. When we first opened Spite and Dival, we would close on the 4th of July, and I would stay up all night the prior night barbecuing for mm-hmm. everyone. We'd have a private party for all our employees and regulars. And once Spite was open for a few years, and we knew we wanted to do something else, this space across the street became available. It was an old auto mechanics garage, mm-hmm. which you really can't get a better space for a barbecue joint in my mind.
And it still looks like that. You've preserved that.
Yeah.
Well, we're
literally still attached to a functioning auto mechanics garage. And my issue at the time, when we were about to open and thinking about doing it, there was some decent barbecue in New York by then. Hmm. But by the early 2000s, there was some okay barbecue, much better than it had been years prior. But the thing I thought they were missing the most was, a couple of things. One certainly was paying attention to the quality of the meat they were using. But the general thing I think they were off on was doing barbecue the way it's done down south. And I don't mean the way it's cooked necessarily. I mean the way it's eaten and the way it's experienced. And too many barbecue places in New York were New York restaurants. You were experiencing barbecue via a New York restaurant.
Almost white tablecloth
exactly.
and barbecue.
Wine lists, that kind of stuff. The best barbecue I've ever had anywhere else outside the city, in any of the barbecue meccas, was always at joints where you usually waited online.
And
stuff was often sold by weight. And it was communal seating a lot of times. And there were very few side dishes, actually, which is kind of... the antithesis of what most restaurateurs really want. Sides make a lot of money. There's a good profit margin. But the reality is, in really great barbecue places, the focus is on the meat, not mm-hmm. on side dishes.
Right.
And I wanted to recreate that. I wanted to, because to me, the part of eating barbecue, of course, is the food, but the other part is the experience. And it's one of these democratizing cuisines like pizza and hamburgers and hot dogs.
Got to eat with your hands.
You got to eat with your hands, and everyone loves it. It doesn't matter. What your race, religion, social status, income, any of that is. Everyone loves that kind of stuff across the board. Mm-hmm. And everyone eats it. And even if you don't know it, even if you've grown up in Maine and never experienced barbecue until you're 30 years old, it's sort of undeniable. Yeah. If you like meat, it's kind of hard not to like barbecue.
For sure. But you buffered that with you didn't put the wine list then. You did the takeout line, but you have a great bar. I mean, that's one of the great...
Right.
I mean, how many whiskeys, right?
It's all American whiskey. It's an all American bar for
that's
that matter.
Crazy.
The only non-American stuff, and it's still North American, is we have some Canadian whiskey and we have tequila. and mezcal.
Just think, I think they're 120. I mean, it's super tiny. It's like you use 6-point, you know, font right. To fit
it's
it all.
It's a lot. It's so much. And, you know, when we first opened, there was a handful of craft distillers. So we were taking all their product. And as more came in, we would, let's take it. I thought it was great, this wonderful craft distilling movement that was going on. But it's gotten to the point now where we physically don't have the room. There's so many craft distillers making whiskey.
So you have to be more of an arbiter now.
We do, yeah. We really have to pick
were
and choose.
Were all of them great?
No. Of course, very few, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I still love it. I want to support these guys.
Yes, and, you have to be in place.
Yeah, and I think they're doing really cool stuff. But the truth be told, yes, very little of it is great. Mm-hmm. Some of it is a good amount of it is pretty good, mm-hmm. and some of it is terrible. But you know, that's just the way it goes.
Very interesting. And then Saint Anselm was the next step, and that's a more whole roast kind of
Saint Anselm format. Is you know, it's kind of hard sometimes for me to explain it without, you know, sometimes I'll say it's sort of like a blue collar steakhouse, but it's a grill restaurant. Really, everything is done on a grill at 90-something% of the menu, so that includes most of the side dishes, the vegetables go into grill pans, steaks, chopped seafood. It's kind of an old school, you know, term, but really that's what we're doing. And there the idea was we wanted this kind of semi-luxury experience of eating really great steak. We do this amazing bone-in ribeye. We do lamb saddle. But we really wanted it to be a place where people could come on a Tuesday night from the neighborhood and not really spend a ton of money.
Right.
So our focus there is doing some, you know, oddball cuts of meat. We do lamb shoulder blade steak, which for lamb is really inexpensive. Our biggest selling item there is a butcher steak, a hanger, that we do at $15 for a hanger. And, you know, the idea is to get people to come in more than once a year.
It's got to be an everyday place. Will you fulfill my dream and open a churrascaria with me? I am Brazilian.
Really?
And I go to churrascarias like an idiot, of course, so disappointed by the meat because, of course, I'm spoiled. I always get to eat what falls off the truck, you know. Right. That sounds like I'm stealing it. What literally falls off the truck and, like, has a broken cryo. I'll eat all that stuff. Right. And it's funny, Ann and I go to all these restaurants that we used to love and just say it was great and, you know, the steak frites. And now we're just like, wow, there is a difference.
There's no question. The difference is to me, it's glaring. And I think it's most noticeable in pork. Mm. In beef, it's certainly noticeable. In pork, you know, commercial raised pork, commodity pork, is just dry and flavorless and has no aroma. Mm-hmm. And heritage pork just has this amazing aroma to it, this sort of real porkiness.
That's the free range, too, the healthy healthy muscles. And then tell us about Gotham Artisanal.
Gotham Artisanal is a distribution company I started with two guys I know who have been in the beer and spirits sales business in New York City for a long time. For about 5 years, had a little boutique grocery store called Spuyten Duyvil Grocery. That was really a bottle shop for what we were selling at Spuyten. But because of the way the laws work in New York State, we had to be a bona fide grocery, so we had to have a lot of grocery items. So I really focused on a lot of the Brooklyn-made products that were available and still are. And also, because of the cocktail thing that had been going on, this big cocktail movement, and again, the way the laws are written in New York State, liquor stores can't carry mixers and syrups and bitters and things like that. And most grocery stores weren't carrying that stuff. It's not really what they do. So we really made it our specialty to focus on all these cocktail bitters and mixers and syrups and all, you know, cocktail-related items like that. So when we closed the grocery store, I was a little disenchanted with the grocery store business. A little difficult, I think, coming from on-premise type of business like a bar or restaurant and then going to this off-premise thing. The margins.
We have trouble selling at grocery stores because they're perfectly nice, but it's just the logistics.
Yeah, the logistics are a pain.
Warehousing.
The margins are so small unless you are a really big store, it's very difficult to make any kind of money. So instead, what we did when we closed the grocery was we started a distribution company because as I was calling all of these producers of these products, none of them had distribution. It was all like, hey, I'll ship it to you via FedEx or that kind of thing. So we kind of, you know, curated a list of who we thought were kind of the cooler producers and brought them all in, and now we're distributing for New York and New Jersey all these cocktail bitters and syrups and mixers and a lot of old timey sodas.
Do you have a Carroll Group truck that makes these deliveries?
Well, we have Gotham artisanal trucks. Oh, okay, yes, yeah, absolutely, yeah. And well, you know, Whole Foods and Citarella and all those guys are carrying our stuff.
That's awesome. We could do a whole show just on that. We're going to cut to a break, but tell us about Chez José.
Chez José is something I'm really excited about. It's kind of in its infancy as far as us being involved with it right now. But José Ramirez Ruiz, I think is his name, I could be flipping that around. He's this fantastic chef, 28-year-old kid, grew up in Puerto Rico, worked at Per Se, worked at Lincoln. He was the sous over at ISA and has been doing this as a pop-up for maybe a year and a half, maybe a little less. And it's what he calls vegetable forward. So there are proteins on a lot of the plates, but it's really vegetable dominant. It's generally about 10 courses, and the food is just really cool. It's a little on the avant-garde side, but really cool and interesting stuff. So we have this small space that we had a little fried fish thing in that didn't work out too well for us. So, and it's perfect. He doesn't want to do more than about 20 or so sittings per. He's doing two services a night, and he wants about 20 covers per sitting. So it's perfect space. Right now, it's just he and his girlfriend, who is an absolutely phenomenal pastry chef, working the whole thing. I mean, they're doing everything. They're bringing out the plates. They're doing the dishes. They're doing everything. Prior to them coming on board with us, they were doing everything out of their house, out of their apartment. So he's very happy now to have a proper kitchen and all. Wow. It's still just 2 days a week, Tuesday, Thursday, but hopefully come the fall, this will be a full-time operation and really rounded with a nice wine list and so forth.
A lot of people would have said, no way, José, to that proposition. But we'll be a very brief break, and I will be right back with Joe Carroll and Aaron Fairbanks.
By herself in a mother's summer dress. Oh, kid, she doesn't need your help. She studied art in Spain. Tall boys across her brain. Yeah, tall boys, men, they'll do anything. They sat her in the shade, threw her a parade. All lined up, marching back and forth all day. She's bored.
The song you're listening to is Boy Crazy by Cookies, and this is The Main Course on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Today's program has been brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run commercial offset print house that brings together environmentally friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Founded in 1998 by Eugene Lee and his father, Cam Lee, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and green technology. Rolling Press prints using soy and vegetable inks, uses a variety of certified and recycled papers, and they incorporate a chemical-free production process. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
Well, she is actually the person who runs the farm back of Roberta's. So, wow, she is very talented. What's her name?
Melissa Metrick.
Melissa Metrick, that's right.
Friend of the station.
Well, that was very fascinating, Jack, wasn't it, to hear all this about Joe Carroll and his Carroll Group, all these very important places in Brooklyn?
All my favorite places. I've had two birthdays at Fête de Sel.
Nice.
But now I'm dating a vegetarian. Ooh, it's tough.
Ouch.
Yeah, but owner of the Two Boots Empire.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, which is all historic. They made documentaries, and they have a film coming out now about the early 70s.
You know, I lived on Mulberry between Houston and Bleecker for years. And
You have one like 4 or 5.
Well, there's one on Bleecker, like two blocks away, not even. And I can't tell you how. I'm almost embarrassed to say how much Two Boots I ate in the throughout the 90s.
That's what I was saying. And of course, what I did in those, I don't want to say something, but like over all the years, like First Kisses, you know, Drunk in the Bathroom, know, just coming back for 3 slices in 3 hours after 3 a.m. I mean, whatever. It was crazy. They definitely see a lot of us. Anyway, back to the questions I wanted to ask. So staffing, you have all these different things going on. What is your kind of, do you have a headline on how you treat people or delegate or how you empower people to run all these facets of the business as well as you would, you know, if you would be there or as close as possible?
Well, you know, I think I have a somewhat unique circumstance in that I really have no background in this business. Prior to opening Spite and Dival in 2003, I worked in the music business, and I studied music as an undergrad, and I played music. I never thought I would do anything outside of the music industry. So I didn't have a lot of knowledge and experience to you know, work with when I opened these places. Where my strong points are, where they lie really, is in the product, knowing the product very well, and knowing how to create a cool concept and execute it. So I do heavily rely on a few people who have vast backgrounds in the restaurant business. I have 3 main people who do most of the heavy lifting for me.
Okay.
As far as dealing with all the employees, we're up to, all said with all of my places now, we're somewhere in the 90-something employees, wow, which is a fair amount. You know, but my feeling on it is just we try to treat people like adults and not like children, and really be as cool and on level with them as possible, and really give them a lot of leeway to do stuff on their own. And I think that's appreciated. Our turnover rate is extremely low. A lot of my employees have been with us for many years, 8 to 10 years already. And you know, I don't know that there's a very specific formula that we use. It's just kind of what feels right and how best to approach things. I still deal with, you know, a lot of the bigger picture stuff. The one thing I do every single week to this day is I do all of the ordering for any beverages. Mm-hmm. So beer, wine, whiskey, and so forth. I still take care of all of that. I feel like, again, that's my knowledge base is deeper than anybody else who really works for me. And I also have that's the one thing where I do have years of kind of experience and connections and people, you know, I know all the brewers and winemakers and distributors and importers and all that stuff very well. So I often know what's going on before some of the distributors who are selling the product even have it. So I retain that aspect as far as day-to-day type of stuff goes. We're lucky in that all the places are very busy. They're all fairly small spaces. I mean, that's kind of what we're dealt with in Brooklyn. And 3 of them are right next to each other. So it makes managing them a lot easier. So we can share people and people can float.
More eyes. So talk about Williamsburg, how that neighborhood's changed since you first, or is it really just the same?
God, no. I mean, my first experience really in any capacity with knowing about what was going on in Williamsburg goes back to probably 89 or 90 when I was at NYU and I knew people who were, you know, a person here or there who were slowly moving out to Williamsburg to get these giant spaces and you know, they had bands and they were artists and so forth. And at the time, you could still get stuff like that, like in Alphabet City and parts of the Lower East Side. But I think it was attraction of not just cheap rent, but the size of some of the spaces out here that people were coming out to. But for me, you know, back then it seemed like I had no interest. I wasn't an artist and I wasn't really a musician, even though I was studying music. So I stayed in Manhattan for a long time. But then as the 90s progressed, more and more friends were going out to Brooklyn. And I would say I didn't start coming out here. Actually, the first thing I probably did coming out to Williamsburg was going to Domsey's. You remember Domsey's? Domsey's was this amazing, gigantic secondhand clothing store.
Oh, yes.
That was on Kent Avenue.
Yeah.
And so that was probably early-ish 90, you know, maybe 92, 93 when I first started going out there. And then, you know, by the mid-90s, there was some stuff going on. There was a couple of bars and restaurants out here, and I knew a lot more people out here. But I was living in Manhattan, I was happy, and things were great. It wasn't until right around the millennium that Manhattan the complexion of Manhattan was changing, and for not necessarily the better, not in a dangerous way. It just kind of was becoming just overrun. It was too many people in
Manhattan. Yeah, yeah.
Downtown, which was really a haven for artists and musicians and people like that, no longer was. It was, you know, stockbrokers and
crumbling and under its own. And, yeah.
So we knew that when we were opening Spuyten, we really, though we looked at a place or two on the Lower East Side, we really wanted to be out in Williamsburg, even though
you
at
felt
the time
it was going to flow. You felt more would come.
You know, I felt a lot of things. Partially, I felt like, never having done any of this before, it was a little less stress and pressure, and if we made a mistake, we weren't under the spotlight as much, and maybe it was a little more forgiving. I don't know if that's true or not. That's just what I thought. And I just like the scene out here. It there's something, even though it's there's a lot of people here, and it's still New York City, and it's very densely populated. It has a small town vibe to it. It really does. Now, granted, I know that owning businesses in the neighborhood help that, but you know, I could walk around the street, walk down any street in Williamsburg, and most likely I'm going to run into people I know. And you don't get that in Manhattan, at least not anymore. Maybe 30 years ago
you did. If you do, it's a miracle, and you tell everyone about it.
Exactly.
So tell us about the kind of obstacles and good things about partnering with another group, because I know Fetisau opened in Philadelphia, and you partnered with another group. So what are some of the things you would warn people about, but also tell people to, you know, follow when you kind of, I don't want to say franchise a concept, but...
Yeah, it's not a franchise. It's a joint venture.
Joint venture.
And really what happened was I kind of knew Feta should be in some other markets, but I didn't have the desire or really the staff to start bringing people into other markets to operate in other markets. So I needed somebody to help me operate. So I partnered with Steven Starr, who is a big restaurateur, and they operate extremely well. I mean, that's what they do. I mean, they are, you know, bar none, great operators. They're really, you know, I'm a little shocked. I did think we would have, of course, the negotiation with the lawyers and everything, getting it going took forever, and that's just typical BS that you deal with. But I actually thought there would be a little more, you know, issues between what he wanted, what I wanted, kind of thing. And it has not been the case at all. I've had an absolutely wonderful time working with his group and his people. And I think he immediately, and that's what warmed me to working with him in the first place from day one. He wanted me to basically run the show as far as how it was going to go down, what we were doing. I have full control over all the creative aspect, any of the food. So they can't say, well, the food cost is too high. We're bringing in commodity meat. It just can't happen.
Oh, wow.
So that
you wrote that into the contract?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something very important to me.
Well, so that's reassuring, because, you know, we always say the slow food movement, sustainable food movement, it needs to do things like that to grow, because only the food should be slow. Making the world slow, that can't happen.
And, you know, it's worked out in a really cool way in that he's gotten turned on from some of the product that we're using that he's now using lot of his restaurants.
His one restaurant that bought from us was Morimoto. Which still buys since the day they opened. Hey, Jack, are you still concentrating out?
I'm here.
Well, it's because it's show 00, and because Max now is just starting to make sounds and, you know, become his own, I'm going to ask my first old man question.
Okay.
For the new season. So,
is this going to be every show from now on?
No, but it's a sign that I'm getting old. Joe, how do you run it all with the family?
I have really, really great managers. I mean, that's absolutely... Look,
did you make rules growing up, I mean, in the business world, saying, hey, listen, never on weekends or never don't
call... No, I don't think you could do... At least I don't think I could do
especially
that.
Especially in an entrepreneur world.
Yeah, in this type of business, too... You know, look, weekends are our busiest time. I can't say, hey, don't talk to me on the weekends, know? But luckily for me, because I have no experience on the floor in restaurants, really, when the like little restaurant-y issues come up, I'm not the guy anyway who is best to deal with it.
Right.
When the big problems, the things that require lots of money and stuff like that, when that comes up, that's when I get called in. But it's really bad. I think it's two things. It's, without a question, having excellent management, and that said, all the way down to bartenders and porters mm-hmm. and everyone just being really good mm-hmm. and hiring great people. But it's also, you know, I live a mile away. So if I'm not there, at least I have the security knowing that I can walk there in 10 minutes.
Yeah. Know? That is nice. Takes me about 25 by car because of the BQE.
Right.
But listen, you should do your own show. That's what I think.
Sure.
You have your own weekly show. I'm sure we'll figure out something right. Two, we should open a churrascaria and fulfill my Brazilian lineage.
I think that's a great idea because you're right. That's the issue. That's the issue with the legendary barbecue places down south. And that's and
just imagine having a sword and, you know, everyone has like tongs because they pull off the meat and be able to offer six breeds of chicken.
Right.
And they can be like, well, what breed is that? You know, I mean, it could be complicated, but I think a modern day churrascaria also where people can pick from 10 different breeds of cow
that'd
for their
be,
steak.
That'd be pretty badass.
Yeah, no, that would be pretty badass.
You know, people,
I've been trying to do it with Shauna from Back 40, who is Brazilian.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm like, somebody's got to do this sometime, and I want to be part of it, because it'd be a real testament to biodiversity, too, for the meat world. And carnivores need their, you know, progressive steakhouses, too, you know?
Of course they do, absolutely. And that's, look, that's been very important to us from day one. I've never wanted to serve any product that I wouldn't want to eat myself. And I don't want to eat commodity meat. I just don't. Look, sometimes I have to. There's no way around it.
The bacon in every BLT is basically from a corrupt system 90% of the time, you know.
And so. I don't want to be part of that. It bothers me on many levels to
Well, those animals suffer.
Yeah, look, there are so many issues with it, so many problems. It's not just the animal suffering. There's a litany of problems. I mean,
but for me, it's always been about that. The animals, that cannot be part of the program.
Right.
I mean, when you have people like Temple Grandin needing to bust the hell in there and being like, oh, my God, something is wrong. These guys have had too much time to think about it, too much pressure to show short-time quarterly reports, and they just push these poor beasts. I mean, they arrive to the slaughterhouse not just mind wasted and curiosity never finding an outlet, but genetic issues. I mean, it goes on and on. And as you speak, all the environmental and this and that.
So many issues with
it. Really makes you sad. Well, read the Carnivore's Manifesto. Comes out in the spring of 2013, written by me and another host on the network, Mike Edison. I want to thank Joe Carroll for spending time. I know how busy you are. Thanks so much for coming
My
in.
Pleasure.
And hope you do this show thing. And I want to thank Jack. What an honor. The Jack Inslee.
Oh, man, stop.
Issue 00, episode 00 of the new season. This is when the season starts. So happy Labor Day, everyone, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.